You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Geeky quants who invented complex and barely understood financial products like derivatives, credit default swaps, and collateralized debt obligations received much of the blame for the disastrous financial meltdown of 2008. But James Owen Weatherall, who is a physicist, philosopher, and mathematician, takes a different view. His new book, The Physics of Wall Street, tells the history of this strange and some say unnatural partnership between science and finance and explains why he thinks that relationship is here to stay. His book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased to welcome James Owen Weatherall to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Referring to the disaster of 2008, Warren Buffett famously said, "Beware of geeks bearing formulas." Is that because he doesn't understand what's happening in these kinds of analysis?
Well, perhaps in part. It's also tongue-in-cheek. Warren Buffett, of course, employs an awful large number of geeks-bearing formulas at Berkshire Hathaway. It's not as though he doesn't use these models himself. So I think that
But it is true that the mathematical complexity of financial products being traded played a role in the meltdown.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. But I think we have to be careful about what role it played in the meltdown.
It's been pointed out that the chance of someone steadily boosting the value of his company by 20% a year for half a century is 1 in 3.5 million. And that's what Warren Buffett has done. But you say he isn't the best investor and Berkshire Hathaway isn't the most successful fund.
So at least over the last 20 years, the firm that I point to as the best, or the money manager I point to as the best, is a man named Jim Simons, who started a company called Renaissance Technology.
Now, and why isn't that as well known as Hathaway?
Well, I think that in some circles it's just as well known. They're very secretive, though, and the kinds of strategies that they adopt are more difficult to understand and more difficult to get a handle on.
And what kind of return have they shown?
I can point to a few different numbers. Over the course of the 90s, from when the fund started until 2000, they returned about 2,500%.
Bernie Madoff did that well.
He didn't do that well, as a matter of fact. The only other fund that came close was George Soros's Quantum Fund at just over 1,700%.
So how well did Renaissance do in 2008?
Well, in 2008, they returned 80%.
So I would assume that they'd be copied by a lot of people, and there have been attempts. Why did Long-Term Capital, which tried to copy their approach, have such a terrible failure?
Well, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that Long-Term Capital Management was copying the Renaissance approach. They were doing something a little bit different, I think. So Long-Term Capital Management was run by finance people. It was, you know, they had a half dozen Nobel laureates on their scientific board. I want to suggest that they may not have been thinking about the models they were using in the best way.
So you're suggesting that people who are very sophisticated about finance aren't the best people to run a program, run a fund?
Well,
Nobel laureates?
I want to be a little bit more modest than that. I want to suggest that physicists have brought something interesting and important to the table, and that people with traditional backgrounds in finance and economics would do well to listen.
We think of derivatives as something that is relatively new as a financial instrument, but you say they've been around for 4,000 years?
They have. In fact, archaeologists have found clay tablets from ancient Babylon in modern-day Iraq recording futures contracts. First Greek philosopher, Thales of Miletus, is recorded as having made the first options contract. These things have been around for a very long time.
And have they been used consistently? Have we just not been paying much attention?
Absolutely. They played an essential role, for instance, in early markets in late medieval Europe.
Well, theoretically, don't hedge funds use derivatives so that they can make money no matter what happens?
Well, that's the plan. Of course, it doesn't always work.
These funds are run and designed by people who are called quants in the trade. What are quants?
Well, a quant is just short for quantitative trader or quantitative analyst. Quants tend to be people, early on they were people with backgrounds in fields like physics and mathematics and computer science, statistics. Increasingly, those ideas have worked their way into mainstream finance, and so people with PhDs in finance and MBAs have some of that training.
And why did their sophisticated mathematically designed models fail them in 2007-8?
Well, you have to be very careful. There was one model in particular that failed in 2007 and 2008 fairly spectacularly. And it was that model that I think is the one that deserves blame, or maybe even better, the people who were using that model, or even better still, credit rating agencies that were taking that model at face value without questioning the assumptions that were going into it that are to blame.
And what was that model?
Well, it was a model that was used to price a particular kind of contract known as a consumer debt obligation. A collateralized debt obligation, a CDO. And the way the model worked was it assumed that there would be no correlation between defaults on mortgages in different parts of the country.
So the one of the problems was that the tools these funds were using to manage their money were already obsolete?
Well, in this particular case, it wasn't just quant funds that were using this model. Everyone was using this model. In fact, I would say that the problem in this particular instance was that the particular securities, the particular products that were being priced using this model, these CDOs, had been fit into the infrastructure of modern finance in such a way that literally everyone participating in the industry was in some way invested in these products. And so when this one model failed, it had ramifications that spread out throughout the entire industry. I don't think that you can limit it to quant funds. And of course, the damage that was wrought in 2008 went much, much deeper than quant funds.
The reason I asked about it being obsolete is it's my sense that things change so rapidly that in many cases, not just on Wall Street, but all over the world, we're always fighting the last war.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in this particular instance, what happened, the sense in which the model was obsolete was that the conditions in the market changed. They changed in a very specific way, which was that the housing market began to drop. And when the housing market dropped, this particular assumption regarding correlations between different mortgages became very, very bad. Now, as a quite general principle, though, this is one of the biggest challenges facing people who attempt to use mathematics to model the market, is that markets change. In fact, one of the principal drivers of market changes is the development of new modeling technologies.
My guest is James Owen Weatherall, who's written a book called The Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable. Your bio on the book jacket calls you a physicist, a philosopher, and a mathematician, but not someone who's worked in finance.
That's right. My perspective on this is, I think, a little bit unusual. I come to it as someone who's trained in physics, but who works principally now in the philosophy of science. And what I take the question that I address in the book to be is, how should we understand these mathematical models that are used in Wall Street? How should we understand the methodology? Can we think of them as reliable? And that's the kind of question that comes up quite often in philosophy of science. What we try to understand in that field is what to make of scientific theories.
And also the philosophy of gambling, because gambling comes up again and again in
Sure.
the discussion in this book.
Absolutely. And questions concerning the foundations of probability are very deep and very old, in this case, very close to the surface.
Well, let's go back to Louis Bachelier. Who was he, and when did he first make a connection between physics and finance?
Well, Bachelier was a French physicist, a mathematician, who wrote a dissertation in 1900, his doctoral dissertation, called A Theory of Speculation, in which he provided essentially in complete form the first options pricing model. But he literally went from zero to 100 over the course of just a couple of years. Before him, there was essentially no work done on the mathematical foundations of markets. There's very little done on probability in the context of financial markets. And he not only developed a model by which we could use tools from probability theory to understand markets, but also showed how those tools could be used to value options on some securities.
But he also dealt with games of chance, didn't he?
That's right. So
I've known people who worked as the private bankers of Wall Street brokers. And they've told me stories about many of them having suddenly coming in and saying, you know, I'm going to need a lot of money because I lost so much at Atlantic City. are the two things inextricably tied together?
It does seem a remarkable number of the people that I talk about in the book. And each of the chapters of the book follows a character, someone who got their start in physics or mathematics and at some point in his or her career made the move to finance or to economics. But in many of those cases, that move was made through some interest in gambling.
So what do probabilities tell us, according to Bachelier?
Well.
isn't the assumption always that the probabilities are only guaranteed to work out in an infinite number of times? For example, if I flip a coin 100 times and it comes out heads 75 times, that's not the same thing as flipping the coin an infinite number of times where it's pretty sure it's going to come out heads and tails equally.
Of course. Understanding probability is something that has vexed people much smarter than me for hundreds of years. And I don't think that that's what we need to do in order to figure out how to use mathematics in order to better understand markets.
Okay, so Bachelier invented mathematical finance, but it didn't make him wealthy.
No, in fact, there's no evidence that he used any of the tools he developed in the markets. There's a small amount of evidence that he worked at the Paris Bourse, at the Paris Stock Exchange, during graduate school and perhaps in the years immediately afterwards. But it doesn't seem that he put his theory of speculation to use. That came much later.
My guest is James Owen Weatherall, who is assistant professor of logic and philosophy of science at the University of California, Irvine. His book, The Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with James Owen Weatherall. His book, The Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And it's about the growing trend to apply the laws of physics to finance. So let's talk about Brownian motion. How does it relate to investing?
Well, Brownian motion is named for an early 19th century botanist, Robert Brown, who observed that pollen particles, when suspended in water, undergo a kind of random motion. This was explained in 1905 by Einstein, who gave a model for what was called a random walk process. And the idea is that you could understand the motion of these pollen particles as though they were undergoing just that, a random walk. They were, you know, their motion at any particular instant is going to be random in any direction.
It's also been called a drunkard's walk.
That's right.
So why do you say investing in the stock market can be explained by a physics theory based on a drunkard's walk?
Well, this was an idea originally due to Louis Bachelier, the French mathematician and physicist who in 1900 wrote a dissertation called The Theory of Speculation. What he suggested was that one could understand the change in stock price at a given instant as essentially a random move in one direction or another. But the important insight is that if that's how you understand the change in price at each instant, you can use that to develop a theory for what the probabilities will be for prices to take certain values at times in the future.
Well, people do have information when they invest, information that can indicate whether the value of a stock is likely to rise or fall. So how can stock movement be random?
Well, this is a subtle issue. On the one hand, there's an argument that in order for a stock to trade, this is the argument that Bachelier himself made, in order for a stock to trade, you need to have someone in the market who thinks it's more likely to go up than go down. That person's going to buy. And you need to have someone in the market who thinks it's going to, more likely to go down than to go up, and that person is going to sell. And the idea is supposed to be that if you take into account all of the people participating in a market and all of the information that they have, whatever value a stock or some other security is actually trading at an instant reflects, on average, all of their information about whether or not it's going to go up or down. And so it's the price at which there are as many people who think it's going to go up as going to go down.
But then there are other factors. For example, banks are now trading under value, even though they're not totally depressed. They are not where they might be if people trusted banks more.
That's absolutely right. So, and this is an important point and something that I emphasize in the book. There's an argument that you can think of stock prices as random. Versions of this argument go by the name the efficient market hypothesis. Of course, Bachelier didn't come up with that. That was coined by Eugene Fama much, much later. But the way that I think about assumptions like that, and something like the efficient market hypothesis as Bachelier understood it, is as an assumption that allows you to get traction on a problem that otherwise would be very, very difficult. Now, the assumption isn't perfect. The question you have to ask is it good enough that the models you can produce by making that assumption are going to provide information to you that's useful?
On the other hand, every so often we read an article about somebody who threw darts at the stock listings and then followed the things that the darts had accidentally landed on, and they did just as well as the Dow Jones.
Sure. You don't read the stories about the people who do that and don't make any money. No one wants to write that story.
How did the invention of nylon revolutionize industrial research culture?
Well, this is one of the neatest connections, I think, in the book. Bachelier was obscure his entire career. 50 years later, there was another physicist, a man named Maury Osborne, who came up with ideas very similar to Bachelier's, in some ways less advanced, but who did so with a cushy government research job. His papers were published. They were widely read. He was respected for the work. And part of what I try to get to the bottom of is what this change in culture was, this change in research culture, such that someone like Osborne could be successful when Bachelier was not. And I trace it back to changes at DuPont that were made when they tried to bring nylon to market.
And what happened there?
Well, so what happened was that over a very, very short period of time, just a few years, DuPont took nylon, which was a cutting-edge, high-tech research, brand-new polymer, and turned it into a product that could be sold in large quantities. And in order to do this, they needed to radically reconceive how they thought of bringing a product to market, what it meant to go from high tech to everyday use. And this involved, in particular, bringing together people from different parts of the process, bringing together the theoretical physicists, the theoretical chemists, the experimentalists, the applied scientists, the engineers, and the marketers, and having them all work together in a way that before the 1930s would have been unheard of.
Well, Bachelier was influenced by the Drunkard's Walk. Osborne did work on the migratory efficiency of salmon, and he related it to markets?
Well, as a matter of fact, he used ideas that he had developed in his work on markets in order to better understand migratory patterns of salmon. He wanted to understand how different timescales, different ways in which rivers flowed would affect the time it would take a salmon to get from the ocean to its spawning location.
Now, Osborne didn't make himself rich through his work either.
No, in fact, Osborne explicitly thought that there was no way to make yourself rich using these kinds of methods. He thought that he had discovered that markets were perfectly random, and as a result, there was no way to get an edge reliably.
Well, obviously, some people do make themselves rich, so Osborne was wrong.
Well, in fact, this is one of the fascinating things about Osborne. Osborne, he believed something like that his entire career, but he, in his first paper, he made a number of assumptions. He developed this model and concluded on the basis of it that markets were random, that speculation was a zero-sum game, but then spent much of the rest of his career trying to show how the assumptions that he had made weren't quite right, and trying to figure out how, if you tweak those assumptions in order to make them slightly more accurate, you might find ways to get an edge in markets. And he proposed some things, although he never put them into practice.
My guest is James Owen Weatherall, who is assistant professor of logic and philosophy of science at the University of California, Irvine. His book, The Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I want to get back to gambling. How did John Kelly's work provide the connection between information theory and gambling?
Well, John Kelly was a physicist working at Bell Labs, who was a collaborator with Claude Shannon, who is he started in electrical engineering, but was most famous because he invented, in effect, the digital computer. He invented information theory. Shannon, working with another mathematician named Ed Thorpe, who's a character in the book, subject of one of the chapters, sought to work together to build a computer to beat roulette.
Well, first they started with blackjack, which is a lot easier to beat, isn't it? Because you've got 52 cards. Roulette seems to be a lot more random.
Well, so the project that Shannon and Thorpe worked on together was the roulette project. Thorpe had his own project regarding blackjack. Mm-hmm. It was his collaboration with Shannon, though, that exposed him to Kelly's work, and it was Kelly's work that allowed him to solve a problem in his blackjack system. Now, Thorpe's blackjack system is what we now think of as card counting.
Banned in Las Vegas.
Well, they didn't like it then either. he was the first person to definitively show that you could get an edge in blackjack by counting cards.
So, did Thorpe find a way to apply his theories on blackjack? I'm curious about the roulette as well, of course, but to investing?
Well, the work of John Kelly here is the main connection. So what Kelly showed was what to do under the following circumstances. Suppose you find yourself in a situation where someone is offering you a bet. You know that the bet is in your favor, but it's still a probabilistic scenario. You might lose, even though you have reason to believe that if you played long enough and you would eke out a profit of some sort. Kelly showed what you should do in that sort of situation, how much of your money you should bet each time in order to maximize your long-term profits. And this is exactly the situation that Thorpe found himself in when he was counting cards in Las Vegas playing blackjack. He found, if you discover that there are a higher percentage of aces in the deck, say, than under normal circumstances, and you feel that gives you an advantage, it doesn't guarantee you're going to win a given hand. It increases the odds. And what he needed to do is figure out how much to bet under those circumstances.
Well, how does that apply to roulette, where you drop a ball randomly and it falls into a slot randomly?
Well, the connection between Kelly and roulette isn't especially close. What Thorpe and Shannon did with roulette was show that you could build a computer that under some circumstances would tell you that collections of numbers were more likely than others. Now, of course, there too, you have to figure out what to do when you're not guaranteed to win. You're just more likely than normal to win. But it wasn't as subtle a business as with blackjack, where the odds are varying.
Can you describe the Black-Scholes model of options pricing?
Well, sure. The Black-Scholes model of option pricing is, in effect, the same model that Bachelier came up with 75 years earlier. It's a way of associating options prices with the prices of underlying securities and an assumption about what the volatility of those securities are going to be. In effect, an assumption regarding what the long-term probabilities are going to be.
Did Black-Scholes allow banks to sell options and not take any risk?
Well, the idea was supposed to be, and this was the big innovation, this was the thing that distinguished Black-Scholes, even though the math was in some sense the same as what had come before. Black and Scholes observed that their model provided a way for banks to, in some sense, manufacture options that they could then sell. And the idea was supposed to be that you can manufacture these in such a way that you wouldn't be taking on any risk yourself. Of course, as I've said throughout, assumptions go into these models, and they aren't perfect.
As we discovered a few years back.
Right.
In fact, there was an earlier crash, 1987, which surprised a lot of people as well. Everybody thought that Wall Street had become rather scientific.
Well, in fact, what happened in 1987 was that many people had bought a product known as portfolio insurance, and it was based on the Black-Scholes model. And the idea was supposed to be that you could actually buy insurance that would prevent you from losing money below a threshold. And part of what happened in 1987 was not only did portfolio insurance fail spectacularly, it actually contributed to the crash because everyone was selling the same kinds of products at the same time.
A recent visitor to our show is the man behind the Black Swan theory. Can you explain how that applies?
Well, the idea behind the Black Swan is that there are the most important events facing not just markets but society quite generally are extreme events that fall outside of our expectations.
Hurricane Sandy,
for instance.
So it's the unpredictable. We're working out all these models with the idea that everything is just going to run smoothly, and then suddenly something happens, an attack on the World Trade Center in 9/11,
right,
or Hurricane Sandy or Katrina or earthquakes or whatever.
Of course, Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, the sense in which they're unpredictable, the sense in which they are events beyond our ability to anticipate them, is rather limited. I mean, we now have good reason to believe that hurricanes are getting stronger, for instance, and we did in 2005.
So we're going to have to write them into the equations now.
Well, there's a sense in which that's right, and there's a sense in which we know how to do that already.
Now, listeners have been writing in, obviously interested in this conversation. I'd like to read a few of the things that they've asked. Tom from Seabright, New Jersey, asks, how do you speculate – how does he, I guess, mean speculate the theories he's speaking about would factor in insider trading, cheating, corruption, and whether markets are random or rational in any way?
Well, the way I think about it – so I'm not sure how to think about factoring in things like insider trading. I suspect that's something that can be done, and it seems to me to be an interesting problem. It's not one that I've seen anyone take on. On the other hand, it's not as though these models somehow are implicated in that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that also is kind of an answer to Aaron on Twitter, who asked, is it ethical for a quant to purposely design a financial instrument to confuse regulators?
Well, it seems to me that the answer to that is pretty clear. It seems to me that the answer is probably no. I don't mean to somehow try to defend the purposes to which everyone who has ever used a quantitative model has put their model.
A listener notes that physicists are concerned with more than just prediction. They're also concerned with evaluation. and then goes on to say, the mathematically difficult area of evaluation on Wall Street is never addressed in popular discussions, often totally downplayed because of a total lack of appreciation for the challenges involved. Though crucial both to understanding the investment process and to subsequent prediction, evaluation is extremely more conceptually, not just practically, difficult than commonly believed.
Well, I have to admit, I'm not exactly sure what the writer means by evaluation. One possibility is just valuation in the sense of valuing things like options contracts. And of course, that is a difficult problem, but is one of the principal problems to which mathematicians and physicists and other quants have put themselves.
But you do try to evaluate the health of a company that you're thinking of investing in, its potential for the future. For example, right now people are looking at Google as a company that has failed at everything but being an information provider, whereas other companies like Apple just seem to come up with new ideas all the time. So which one do you invest in?
Sure. And there's also an issue of evaluating the health of the economy as a whole. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how mathematical models might be used for regulatory purposes. Now,
The fiscal cliff didn't seem to affect Wall Street.
That does seem to be the case so far.
Any idea why? Wouldn't that fit in with what we're discussing?
Well, do I have any idea why? I mean, my sense of it is that what happened was exactly what everyone did and should have expected to happen. I don't think you needed any particularly complicated mathematics. It was going to be
applied.
Modest.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Well, anyway, but getting back to I interrupted you there. We were talking about
evaluation,
yeah,
of companies. Well, it seems to me that maybe the right way of putting it is that I think that the mathematical models are tools that need to be part of the toolbox. They need to be part of our arsenal for understanding markets and understanding the economy more generally. They're only some of the tools that we're going to use. It seems to me that there are many ways that we have for evaluating companies. And
well, you're talking about physics here. Are we talking about Einsteinian physics? Are we talking about quantum mechanics?
Well, I think that's the wrong way of asking the question. What I want to talk about here are methodological insights from physics. So the idea being that one of the things that physicists do very well is construct models in the following way. You start by taking a very complicated situation. You identify some simplifying assumptions that you can make, and once you make them, these, in effect, idealizations, you're able to get some sort of quantitative traction. You then immediately ask, how can we expect those assumptions to fail, and how do we expect the model to fail when those assumptions do fail? That's what I take to be the principal contribution from physics here. The idea isn't to somehow take relativity theory and apply it to markets, or take quantum mechanics and apply it to markets.
James Owen Weatherall is assistant professor of logic and philosophy of science at the University of California, Irvine. His book, The Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.